Okay, Your Honor, I represent Rosalba in this case, and I took this case at the beginning, and we've outlined our arguments in our opening brief. And in that opening brief, we outlined why we thought that she had met her prima facie case for why she was a victim of discrimination. And I outlined that in the opening brief, and basically we disagreed with Judge Lavnik in that we believe that there were outstanding issues of fact that precluded summary judgment.
And Mr. Scannell, in employment cases, they're a little bit like, if you listen to the last, they're a little bit like family law cases. They're a little bit, they're human relationships. So there's always right. going to be, it needs to go to contested, disputed issues of material fact. And
right.
so that, you know, there's always going to be able to, if people are together for years, it seems to me to be undisputed that this all started when your client had an accident while she was working and suffered traumatic injury. And by everyone's, it seems to be undisputed that your client could not do the job that she was doing previously. She had been a good employee before that. She was performing at the necessary levels after this. And it seems to me that your client agrees that she can't do what she could before. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So when you're talking about the prima facie case on the discrimination, what is your, what's your basis for that?
Well, to be honest with you, Your Honor, we felt that the issues were outlined in our opening brief, and I had a conversation with this with my clients on this, and I'm partially responsible for this. When we submitted our opening brief, I took it over from another attorney, and I felt that we had strong arguments, the disputed issues we had outlined in our opening brief. And I also felt that my understanding was that Judge Lavnik had gone ahead and ruled on the merits, even though he didn't accept, even though he didn't initially grant the extension of time for submitting the evidence.
Mr. Scannell.
And then what happened was...
Mr. Scannell,
Judge Hawkins has a question of you.
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Your Honor.
Okay. Would you be so kind as to answer Judge Callahan's question, which was, simply put, what is your client's prima facie case of discrimination? I don't want to hear about the brief. I don't want to hear about how you got this case. I want, in a sentence or two, you to answer her question.
Okay, that's what I was trying to do, Your Honor. The problem that we're having in this case is we don't have the evidence to meet the prima facie case right now, because I was under the understanding that the judge had ruled on the evidence that we had submitted late, and we were preparing the argument based on that evidence. When we received the response brief, I discovered that in a footnote, Judge Lavnik had not allowed the extension of time, and even though he considered it in the his argument in his ruling, he very clearly in a footnote that I hadn't discovered before ruled that he was not granting an extension of time. And with that, I told my clients on the reply brief, I said, I can't defend this case any longer because we don't have any evidence based on our initial response. And there was no notice of appeal filed on the, there was no notice of appeal filed on the denial of the extension of time. And so my client instructed me to simply go in there on the briefing that we've had, and that's what I'm doing. And quite honestly, Your Honor, if we're not granted that extension of time, we didn't have any evidence that could have defeated summary judgment. I proceeded on that, and it was my fault. I proceeded under the assumption that there was enough. We had a good argument if he had considered our evidence, but I misread his order because I thought he had considered our evidence. And he was very clear in a footnote saying that he was not granting the extension of time, and there was no notice of appeal filed on that.
Well, this is Judge Gilbert. You can't file a notice of appeal just based on a denial of a motion for extension of time because that's not a final disposition.
Right, but it should have been included in the things of the orders that we were filing. And there was no notice of appeal on the extension of time. And without that, we didn't have an argument for the final order. In my view.
So let me ask you this. Is there any independent evidence in the record that supports Ms. Mayorga's assertions that Caucasians applying for the same positions as Ms. Mayorga received favorable treatment on account of their race?
Yes, we had, if you
other than her statement, you can't, you know, there's an argument you can't just make a conclusionary statement. And right. There were some white males that got it, but it looked like she wasn't qualified for the position. So I'm assuming we're offering that for pretext, if we got to pretext.
Yeah, and I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. If we had gotten the extension of time, which we didn't, or excuse me, if we had appealed the denial of the extension of time, they did have in the record a comparator, which the other side has claimed for various reasons evidentiary wise didn't apply. And it was in the process of addressing that I discovered we didn't have any evidence. But if we did have a comparator, but I never got around to, I decided it would be fruitless to go and address their evidentiary questions when it wasn't even before the court yet. But yes, there was a comparator that we had in the record. Unfortunately, the record, it never got entered into the record because he denied the extension of time.
Was that Mr. Barr? Is that who you're referring to?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah.
Well, would you like to reserve time for rebuttal, see what the other side said, and then respond to that?
Yeah, if the other side wants to, you're asking if you want to cede the time to the other side right now?
Well, no, you can have all the time on rebuttal. You can hear what they have to say, and you can respond to that on rebuttal.
Okay, I'll do that then.
You know, it's up to you. I'm just saying you have 15 minutes total if you want to reserve the balance right now for rebuttal.
Let's reserve for that, Your Honor.
All right. Then we'll hear from the other side, and then you'll have 6 minutes and 42 seconds on rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the court. I'm Scott Barber, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Washington and the individual defendants in this case. I was actually quite surprised to just hear from counsel for Ms. Mayorga two things, a clear acknowledgement that she wasn't able to do the job and a clear evidence or clear statement that they do not have evidence of the prima facie case. Those to me seem to be dispositive, but nevertheless, in the comments that were just made, several times it was referred to as a motion for extension of time that was denied. There was no motion for an extension of time in the issue in this case related to the summary judgment. The summary judgment that was filed had a response timely filed in this case, including the declaration of Ms. Mayorga. The motion that was denied was to, after the defense reply was filed, file a brand new, completely different response to the motion. And the district court denied that motion because they had already responded and there was no indication that they needed additional time. at the time the response was filed, that they were incapable of responding within the rules. But nevertheless, the court did review their supplemental response in order to see whether there were any additional facts that caused concern for the court, and there were not.
Did the court analyze, the court found there was no prima facie case. Did the court go through the additional analysis and say, even assuming there's a business reason that's given, and then go through pretext, or what did the court, or did the court just stop at prima facie?
I believe, Your Honor, that the order stopped at prima facie, but did talk about the issue of pretext. And in this case, the undisputed evidence from Ms. Mayorga is that she was not capable of doing her pre-injury job, which means that any claim for disability discrimination fails with regard to her in her position of pre-injury. It is undisputed that the vacancy searches that were conducted during the disability reassignment were limited by Ms. Mayorga and failed to identify any vacant funded positions for which she was qualified or could be accommodated, which means there was no discrimination in the context of the disability reassignment. And in the context—
She said something about, she identified in her brief 8 specific examples of positions she said she was qualified for, but were filled by Caucasians instead. Why doesn't this create a jury question as whether she was discriminated against based on race and national origin?
The first reason for that, Your Honor, is that Ms. Mayorga lacks foundation for the statements she's made. A statement to the effect that someone is a Caucasian is an observation made by someone that is independent of national origin or ethnicity. In fact, standard questions on ethnicity talk about Caucasian, Hispanic, for example, non-Hispanic. Caucasian is too broad a term, and Ms. Mayorga has no demographic information that would support her determination that people who were Caucasian, who actually identified as Caucasian, filled the positions.
Excuse me.
Yes, Your Honor.
Didn't she file a table, and I'm referring to ER Volume 1 at pages 7 through 10. Didn't she say, here's a table with a list of positions that I am qualified for that were not offered to me but filled by other people?
To begin with, Your Honor, the table is nothing more than Ms. Mayorga's assertion for which she lacks foundation. There was no discovery done by Ms. Mayorga. She did not get any demographic information from DSHS. She did not identify when those positions were filled relative to her own availability for reassignment. And you must keep in mind that from 2013 until early 2016, DSHS was attempting to accommodate her within her position of pre-injury. So any position that was open and filled during that period of time is not one that she would have been considered for in terms of reassignment. The vacancy reassignment search happened after it was determined, based on medical information and with Ms. Mayorga's agreement, that she was not able to perform her pre-injury position. And therefore, the reassignment process looked at cases that are positions that were vacant and funded, did not carry a caseload, and were not heavy in terms of multitasking, which was a significant problem for Ms. Mayorga as a result of the traumatic brain injury. So without the information from DSHS demonstrating when the positions became available relative to Ms. Mayorga's disability reassignment, the demographic information about who filled them, whether in fact Ms. Mayorga would have been qualified, is an evidentiary issue. It's not enough for her to simply say, I'm qualified. She has to be able to demonstrate that the position is one that she was in fact qualified for. Her table alone is insufficient evidentiarily to create an issue of fact.
Did the state of Washington respond to this table?
We did not, Your Honor.
In the papers?
We did not, Your Honor, other than to object to the evidence. It was submitted in response to summary judgment, and so we were on reply. And the factual record, the evidentiary record created during discovery, did not get at any comparators whatsoever.
So Ms. Mayorga asserts that the state could have modified her social services specialist 3 positions so that she would not have had to carry any cases and that she could have continued to perform that role under those circumstances. Could the position have been modified? Was any modification offered?
Modification that you've just suggested, Your Honor, is absolutely not one that can be created. It is an essential function of the pre-injury position that she carry a caseload. Her job as a social services specialist 3 pre-injury, pre-assignment process, was to carry cases for children who were already in dependencies. She was responsible for visiting them monthly, making sure that they were getting all of the support they needed, medical, educational, food, clothes. She was required to make court appearances.
She was where she was asking for the natural helper on this job?
That is one of the things that they have suggested, Your Honor. But the natural helper is a reference to something that was suggested and is nowhere else in the record. There is no indication of what a natural helper is. But more importantly, Ms. Mayorga acknowledges that her supervisor, Ruth Haggerty, was in fact performing the role of natural helper, in that Ms. Haggerty was the person who could best accommodate her, granted her leave, allowed her to have a graduated return to work in terms of hours, allowed her to have a graduated return to work in terms of caseload, allowed her to not drive at any time she felt like she was not comfortable driving, and granted her considerable leave. Ms. Mayorga used approximately 3,500 hours of leave between her accident and her disability separation. DSHS did everything they possibly could have to support Ms. Mayorga in her pre-injury position before they moved to reassignment. And in fact, Ms. Mayorga acknowledges that that was the case. And when she looks for, or when she claims national origin discrimination, the only evidence she points to is that she didn't get hired into the job that she believed subjectively she was qualified to do, having never done it before. And that's in ER4 at pages 90, 94, 95, 108, 109, 110. Those are all deposition testimony from Ms. Mayorga.
How large is this group? How many employees were in this group?
If by in this group, Your Honor, you mean the Mount Vernon office where Ms. Mayorga worked, that is not in the record. DSHS is a very large organization, and in fact, there is evidence in the record that had Ms. Mayorga not voluntarily limited the scope of the search, DSHS would have looked or would have cast a statewide net looking for vacancy positions into which she could have been accommodated.
Well, she limited it. Position at Spokane, but she would have to move for that, right? How does that factor?
So keeping in mind, Your Honor, that disability accommodation is an interactive process. There was a position identified in Spokane that was offered to her. There was not an expectation that she would necessarily take it, and she didn't. It was beyond the scope of what she was asking for anyway, because she limited it to the Mount Vernon office, and she limited it to a single administration within DSHS, that being the Children's Administration. And she only did that after she was told she couldn't limit it to a single position, the relative search specialist position, which, although she believed she was qualified, the undisputed evidence in the record is that she was not qualified to handle it for the very reasons that she couldn't do her previous job. Her traumatic brain injury meant that the skills she needed, including multitasking, which is something she couldn't do, was an absolutely essential part of the relative search position. So in any situation where DSHS identified a position, Ms. Mayorga would still have to be willing to go into it. But if she declined a position that met the search criteria, then that was her choice. And if she declined a position, she could also have been she could have been disability separated. But that didn't happen with the Spokane position because it wasn't within the area she established.
Okay, Your briefing seems to throw in that Ms. Mayorga, she was the one that caused the accident, that caused her injury. Is that relevant to any of this?
It is not relevant to any of this, Your Honor. It's just a fact from the beginning of the accident.
All right. So you're not claiming because she caused the accident that she has any less rights under the fact that she had an accident while she was driving for work?
Absolutely not. And the fact that it's a work-related accident also has no bearing on whether she needed to be accommodated or not. It is simply a fact in this case that it is a work-related injury. And at least as of the time of her deposition, she continues to receive workers' compensation benefits despite her disability separation.
Do either of my colleagues have any additional questions?
No.
No.
Your Honor.
Yeah, you're free to use your time, but we don't have any additional questions. That's up to you.
Sorry, the light just turned off in my room.
You probably have to move around, move your hands or something to activate.
Technology.
Great when it works and not so great when it doesn't work. The motion sensor's on a wall that I keep my waving doesn't do anything for. I apologize for that. This is a sad case.
I take the counsel, what you want to say is you urge us to affirm.
I do, Your Honor. And with that, I will sit down or stand here, but be quiet.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We'll go back to appellant's counsel, Mr. Scannell. You want to?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to some of the stuff he said.
Go ahead.
They have this. And we've laid this out in our opening brief, but they've laid out this step-by-step process in which they claim they did everything that they could and there was no discrimination that was involved. Okay. And that simply isn't the case, because you have to look at the entire picture here, not just whether they passed each individual step that they declared to be the rules, but whether the process itself was discriminatory. And we're saying it was. And there's several issues of fact, very important issues of fact, that should lead this court, if it did consider all the evidence, that would say, yes, there was a trialable issue. To begin with, they started their search before they even got rid of her or did anything. They suddenly come up with a rule that says, we don't need Spanish-speaking people to be qualified for this position. And as we pointed out, Rosa was one of the few in the state that did speak Spanish. So right off the bat, you're looking at, what is their intent here? What is the intent of this process? Is it to hire the most qualified person? Or are we going to start changing the rules in midstream here so we can flood the gate with more applicants so that she won't be able to get it? Okay.
She has still done this, but how do you
question
that she could do the job regardless of that? If you want to state that they retaliated against her for making that statement, she still has to be able to show she can do the job.
And it seems that she conceded she has these limitations. This job does require to multitask. It does require having a caseload. So how does she get over that? I mean, hiring a helper to do the job for you, the law doesn't require that. You know, if hiring, you're required to accommodate, but if accommodation hires someone to do the job for you, that's not accommodation. You still have to be able to show you're qualified. How could she do the job?
Well, where we're saying that the discrimination occurred, Your Honor, is that there were other jobs that she was qualified for. It's true that she didn't qualify for the original job, but we also showed during this job search that she did her own job search and found positions within the department which she could have accomplished. And yet they didn't want to throw those jobs into the mix. They didn't want to say that, these other jobs that she qualified for were a valid accommodation. And then they claimed that, you know, other people were more qualified or whatever. So the issue here wasn't whether she was still qualified for original job, but they were supposed to try to accommodate her to see if there were jobs that were available. And we're saying the fact that they artificially limited the search over a very short period of time. For example, they knew that she wouldn't leave her family and travel several hundred miles to Spokane. But then they set up a process where, oh, well, let's quickly look for a few positions here. Oh, she doesn't qualify for the two that we named, and so therefore it's over. And that occurred over a fairly short period of time.
Counsel, can you hear me?
No, I didn't. Did you?
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. I didn't know you interrupted me. I'm sorry.
Well, it's hard to get a word in edgewise.
Okay.
But I have a question that it's least important to one of the judges on your case. And the question is this. Is an employee in your client's circumstance entitled to define the kind of job that her employer should be looking for her to fill?
I think that may be an employer decision, Your Honor, but if the employer is artificially limiting that becomes a question of fact. If you have evidence that's out there that indicates, like we said, opening it up to non-Spanish speaking people, then I think that if they limit it to a very short period of time to the and don't give her an adequate time to come up with alternatives, then that in itself can be viewed discriminatory. So, like I say, they have the right to define the process. And if my client chooses a job that management decides isn't in the mix, and it's a legitimate decision that management made that way, then yeah, you're right. Management has the right to limit the job search. But what we're saying here is that their choice to limit it to a short period of time and exclude, you know, not allow her to concentrate that search within the geographical area that she wanted leaves open a question of fact as to whether they have discriminatory intent or not.
Did she object to the search criteria used for the two searches that the department used?
I didn't quite catch that. I think you were saying she objects to the search that she was allowed.
No, I'm asking, did she object to the department search criteria on the two searches that the department made on her behalf? Is there anything in the record showing she objected to the scope of those searches?
I'm sorry, I can't answer that question, Your Honor. I'm not that familiar with the record on that particular point. I thought she did, but I can't be absolutely sure.
Okay, well, we'll check the record on that.
Okay, well, we've used all of your time. Let me make sure my colleagues don't have any additional questions.
No,
nothing further.
We don't have any additional questions, so if you want to use 30 seconds, you're already in overtime, but use 30 seconds to wrap up.
I don't have anything more to say, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you both for your argument in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will take a short recess for 10 minutes, and then we'll hear the last case that's on for argument. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.